some things which always fascinated me. What did the Buddha say about the origin of this universe? And it was quite clear from the original teachings of the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, and those are old teachings, predating science, he was actually saying that this was not the first universe, but there's been a whole series, a sequence of universes, one after the other. And this is straight from the text, where he talks about an evolving and devolving of the universe, and eons. And because of his meditation, he could remember himself 91 eons of existence, which is 90 big bangs, if you like, beginnings of universal systems. And you may think that that is just speculation or theory. There's nothing magical about the number 91. That was just what he remembered, just 91. That's as far as his memory would go back. But what really fascinated me was that the age of that universe. And what did the Buddha say when the universe would actually begin? He did say it was a really, really long time. There's an old metaphor, simile, about a bird with a cloth in its beak just brushing past one of the mountains in the Himalayas once every 100 years and saying that mountain would be worn away by just being brushed with a cloth once every 100 years before the eon is finished. So he certainly gave a huge time scale for the age of a universe. But of course that was no real proper indicator of an age. You can't work out in years or centuries how long that universe is. But when I started reading the suttas in Pali, that there's part of those suttas which are very rarely translated in the Anguttara Nikaya. Even now the English translations are very few, but there's one little sutta there. There's actually a lot of interesting sutras in the Anguttara Nikaya. One of them actually says that there are such things as aliens. I thought, wow, that's really weird, the Buddha's saying that. But anyway, that's another talk altogether. In this particular sutta, he was talking about how you can actually work out the age of the universe. Some of you may have had some inkling of this before, because he said that in the heavenly realm just above us, that's the people upstairs. No, the real heavenly realm, the next heavenly realm, the realm of the four great kings, the Buddha says that like one day for those beings is like 100 years of human life, and they live 100 celestial years. And then the realm above that one day is equivalent to 200 human years, and they live 200 celestial years. And the realm above that is increased by a number by four, and the realm above that by a number of four, until you get to the Brahma realm. Each realm above lives a time span four times as long as the one below it. And I know that the Brahma realm lasts a whole eon. And so I thought, hey, now I've got a means of actually calculating the age of the universe. And this is actually, from the suttas. And so I got out a quick calculator. Now, being a mathematician before, I calculated it, and it works out roughly 37,000 million years, according to that calculation, which is a very simple calculation to do. And I thought, hey, that's amazing, because according to most modern astrophysics, as far as I remember the last time I read this, the astrophysicists work out this has been roughly about 13 or 14,000 million years since the Big Bang. In other words, it's in the ballpark. It's a valid figure. It's the right order of magnitude. And as a scientist, I was impressed that someone 2,500 years ago could give an age of the universe which fits the most modern of astrophysics. But more than that, the most recent work which was being done on theories of the Big Bang, why there is a Big Bang, comes from what you, I don't know if there's any physicists here, it comes from a development of the string theories. These are actually planes, multidimensional planes, just as a way of describing it. It's just a metaphor, you don't have to try and imagine this, but multidimensional planes, and when they cross, that is a Big Bang. And it was Professor Epstein, I think it was in Caltech, who developed this theory with a lot of other people. And it is perhaps the most modern and well-accepted theory of the origin of the universe. It predicted not just one universe, but a sequence of universes, just like the Buddha predicted, or rather just like the Buddha knew. And as a scientist, I was very impressed with that, that the Buddha's time scale for universal systems was compatible with the most modern of astrophysics. And I know that because I was a scientist at Cambridge. So it's wonderful to see that here you don't need to bend science to fit your religion, that the religion of Buddhism actually predates science, and it is accurate. But really, that doesn't tell us too much, because we also want to know, okay, that's the material stuff of this universe. Where did life come from, and how does life develop? And what about the other realms of existence, such as heavens and hells? What's the Buddhist explanation for the creation of that? And of course, I've done a lot of research and meditation on the existence of heaven and hells to understand exactly what they are and why they are. And it's a classical Buddhist story, which you may have heard before, but I'm going to extend. It's a classical story of the Japanese samurai warrior who went to ask his favorite Buddhist monk whether there was such a thing as heaven or hell. And according to that story, sort of this samurai had been to many other philosophers, experts, monks, and would never get a straight answer, never one which really satisfies him. Just the same with modern people today. Is there a heaven? Is there a hell? If so, why? What is it? Or is this just, you know, something which religious people make up to scare people? To make sure you keep your precepts, otherwise you go to hell. Or to get donations, say for their retreat center, you must give so you can go to heaven afterwards. Is this just like, you know, a marketing ploy for religions? And of course, I wouldn't sort of do those sorts of things, because I'm an honest monk. But many people would. And so a lot of people talk about hell, they talk about heaven, but how can you know for sure for yourself? So this was a samurai. He really wanted to know, but he didn't want to have any sort of fool of a monk or a philosopher giving him a reason he couldn't, or give him an answer he couldn't really understand, he couldn't really prove. So eventually he went to this old monk, who he respected, and said, "Venerable sir, like, I really want to know, is there a heaven, is there a hell? And don't just, you know, give me a silly answer. If you don't know, just say you don't know, at least I'll respect you." And just the monk looked up to him and said, "You're too stupid to understand an answer about such things." And this was a samurai warrior. So the samurai said, "Venerable sir, I am not stupid. I am a samurai warrior. I'm highly intelligent, very well trained. You give me a proper answer and don't be sort of, don't scold me like that." And the monk just looked up and said, "You're a samurai warrior. Don't give me that. You're a stupid person from the village. No, they wouldn't make you a samurai warrior." And the samurai started to get offended and said, "Look, if you keep on scolding me like that, I'll cut your head off with my sword." With that little rusty old piece of metal, you couldn't even cut a loaf of bread with that. And that really upset the samurai. He got out his sword. He was so incensed, because samurais are very proud. And to be abused that way by this stupid monk, he was about to say, "Right, you asked for it," and was about to strike off his head. And at that, the monk looked up and said, "Samurai, that is hell." And of course, the samurai understood. I always say that monk was pushing his luck. I wouldn't try that. He was very lucky, that monk, because the samurai understood that anger, that ill will, the wanting to hurt and cut off somebody's head, said, that is hell. What that really means, and this is how I extend this, there's another part of this, and I'll do the other part first of all. And then the samurai said, "Oh, thank you, at last someone has given me a straight answer. Someone can understand, I can feel that, that is my experience. Yeah, I know now that hell exists and this is what it feels like." So he went down and bowed to that monk. out of gratitude. He said, oh, thank you, at last I've met someone who can speak some sense, something I can understand, who speaks from their heart. Thank you, thank you, thank you, great teacher. And the monk looked up and said, samurai, that is heaven. Now, that's an old story. Some of you have heard that before. It's a very beautiful story. But to extend it, that monk was saying something far more profound than many people give credence for. Because that feeling of anger, wanting to kill, wanting to hurt, being offended because of your pride, that's what it feels like in hell. Only it lasts much longer. What he was actually saying, he was describing the mind in hell, the emotional state, the feeling state. And if you could imagine that state when you're angry, when you're upset, when you want to do violence to somebody or even to yourself, that's what it's like in hell. Time after time, for endless periods. So you can know that hell exists. And once a person dies, if that's their mind state, when you lose this physical body which changes and actually stops these mind states lasting a long time, in a sort of what the Buddha called a mind-made body, those states will last for much, much, much longer than in the human realm. Which is why if you die with such a state, you are in hell. But I'm not sure if you've been to these temples where they have pictures of people in hell. If you've been to like Tathagatabalam Gardens in Singapore and see all these people boiling in oil, people often ask, is that what it's really like in hell? Do they really boil you in oil with these fires underneath, or do they have electric heaters under the, or do they microwave you? Have they got high technology in heaven these days? Is it all run by computers? Get the temperature scale and the point is, actually this was an insight which came from one of my disciples who had a very deep meditation experiences, but mostly because he had this very painful degenerative back condition. And in the local hospitals where he went, the people in palliative care, the people who deal with people who have got very painful conditions, they decided to have some means of describing to their loved ones and friends what it was feeling like. Because how can you describe pain to another person? Say, it hurts. Yeah, but I mean, how much does it hurt? Because we all have pain from time to time. We may have a headache, but is it just like a mild ache? Or is it just a terrible migraine? When you go to a doctor and say, you know, does it hurt? He said, yes. It doesn't really describe it. Maybe just like a small ache. It may be an intense pain. So with the use of modern machines, they could actually see exactly the intensity of the pain and giving more descriptions on what it feels like. So in this hospital, which was dealing with people in intense pain, they had a whole scale of pain. And in order to describe it to others, they used a metaphor, what it's like. He told me that his pain, the pain he was feeling continuously, was given this description. It was like someone having their arm sort of sawn off. He said, if you can imagine having your arm sawn off with just an ordinary handsaw, and the pain you would feel, that was what he was feeling continuously. Now that was a wonderful way of conveying to the people who cared about him what he was experiencing all the time. It helped his friends and loved ones understand what he was going through. It wasn't just saying it was hurting. It was giving a language where you can actually understand what it was really like. He wasn't having his hand cut off, but that's what it felt like. This is what we mean by language, a way that we can convey an inner feeling to someone else who hasn't got that feeling. And when I understood what he was saying and why he was saying it, all these temple paintings became very clear to me. It's not that if you go to a hell realm you're going to be boiled in oil, but that's what it feels like. The same sort of pain you would feel if you were boiled in oil is what you feel in those states of hell such as through intense anger or wanting to hurt somebody. Now you understand why those temple paintings are there. They're not supposed to be specific and descriptive. That's what happens. These are metaphors. This gives you an understanding of what it must be like. In the same way that my disciple could only describe what it felt like by giving this metaphor of having your hand sawn off. So that is the hell realms, which is also part of our universe. But who creates those hell realms? Has they been created by some monster god? Because, I mean, what person would actually do such a thing to create such awful places of existence? It was one of my problems when I was, trying to get some sense of Christianity. How could a loving creator create such a hellhole? The most, worse than Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, all put together. Sadistic. Who would do that? And of course, now, once I started meditating and understanding the ways of the mind, I understand who created that. You did. We are the ones who create hell. And we are the ones who send ourselves to hell. It's a fascinating thing to know how hell happens and how we create that world. I've made a statement, and it's a very true statement. The doors of hell to escape are always open. People in hell can walk out at any time. They just don't want to. It's called guilt, conscience. I've known this because for years when I've been counseling some of the disciples who've done something wrong, we want to try and give them an act of forgiveness. Just let go. You've done something wrong. Never mind. You were stupid. We all make mistakes. Let go. Don't worry about it. But sometimes it's so hard to try and encourage a person to let go of the mistakes of the past. They just won't let go. They carry around the pain of their past, because they feel they need to be punished. They feel they need to hurt because they've hurt someone else. That delusion, that ill will towards themselves and towards others, is a very basic part of the human mind. It's not a necessary part, because a stage of meditation, you let that go, you can give yourself forgiveness. But there's a stage of the mind we just cannot forgive ourselves, nor can we forgive others. When we have that lack of forgiveness towards others and ourselves, then we will always be subject to the hell realms. Punishing ourselves. No one sends you to hell. You send yourself to hell. It's like when somebody dies, and we feel grief at the one who dies. You don't have to feel grief. You've seen in my story of my book about my father, I never felt grief for one second of my father dying, even though I loved him. It's almost like a celebration of a life, not grief. I remember telling that story at a grief conference in Perth, and this lady came up to me and she was very upset and angry at me. Because she was actually one of the speakers. She'd lost her somebody or other about 3 or 4 years ago in a tragic accident. And she was always going around to these grief conferences saying how she felt. And I was saying, you don't need to feel like that. And that was so challenging to her, to actually to say, listen lady, the door's open, you can walk out, go on, walk out, go on. No! She was attached to her grief. She felt she needed to grieve. She actually made herself suffer. She was in hell. And she couldn't get out of it. And I couldn't let her out either. The door was open, I told her. You can go out. You can let go of that grief at any moment. But she just wouldn't do it. She created her suffering. No one else. Now you understand who creates the world. In the same way, you can create a heaven. No matter what's happening. It is you who create that world. It's not that the world creates you. This is why the creator, according to Buddhism, was always said to be the mind. Okay, the universe this world we live in, the matter, that's well understood how that is comes about. That comes about through science. It's well understood. You don't need any created there. But sometimes people say, well, how about like the evolution of beings? How does that happen? Because it's true to say that just chance, just probability, could not explain the development of all the species on this planet. It doesn't need to have just probability, because there's something else which the Buddha said which drives the evolution of beings. And that's craving, desire, wanting. Now that is what drives this whole process of evolution. If you take Darwin's theory and you add Buddhism, and then you get that mixed together, it's just craving keeps changing the species. And there was one piece of evidence which I read, which was a fascinating piece of evidence, again from science, which actually proves this. I'm surprised this hasn't been reported more widely, because this was the evolution of a species which occurred within the space of only about 10 years. The situation was, in the UK, in Wales, when Margaret Thatcher became the Prime Minister, as many of you may remember, she had a big battle with the unions, especially the coal miners' union. Margaret Thatcher wanted to close down many of the uneconomical coal mines. The unions wanted to keep them going. There was a very bitter battle. Mrs. Thatcher won. The coal mines were closed down. Now in particular, there was one coal mine in Wales, I think just outside the town of Swansea, which was closed down as being uneconomical. It was fenced off. However, in that, close to that coal mine, was a big suburb of Swansea. And like many English people or Welsh people, they always like to have pets, cats and dogs. However, many of the cats would be prolific in having kittens, and many families, when they had excess kittens, they would try and give them to their friends, but there were so many they'd have to dispose of them. And you probably heard that sometimes the way that so-called animal-loving Britons dispose of their unwanted animals is often very gross. In this particular case, but it became the custom in that suburb, if you had some excess kittens you didn't want, one of the most convenient ways was to throw them down the disused coal pit. Had this huge shaft, I don't know how many hundreds of meters it went down into the earth. They'd just break through, or there's a hole in the fence, and they'd just throw the kittens down the hole. Hundreds of meters down. Assuming they would die. However, many of those kittens didn't die. And what happened after about 10 years after the pit was closed down? Some engineers had to go down that pit just to check its safety. And when they went down to check what was happening in the bottom of that coal pit, they found a new species of cat had developed. I saw the pictures in the article, which was strange. I'd never seen any being like that. Because the cats had become blind. Down there, hundreds of meters underground, you could not. There was no light. You didn't see anything. So the eyes had become closed. But what was really strange, the ears had grown very, very large. Much larger than you'd see in any cat. In fact, they were so large, it qualified as a completely new species of cat, if you could call them a cat. Because they needed those ears, both to fend off other aggressive cats from attacking them, to find their food, and also to mate. Because it was dark, they needed those ears. They craved more sensitive ears. And in the space of 10 years, those ears developed. You understand why? Because of craving, it happened. Sometimes you wonder why people are growing taller in most societies. I'll tell you why people are growing taller. Because they want to. Craving can see the change in our species. If Africans want to appear whiter, more like Caucasians. They will. Craving actually will change the development of our species. Now you understand just why species develop the way they do. It's just not natural selection. It's craving actually changing just the way our species develop. Now you understand just how that is the answer to the Christian saying it's just not possible with probability. Of course it's not possible with probability. When you have craving involved there, you can understand just how this world develops. Because craving is what comes from the mind. And the Buddha said the mind is the forerunner of all things. It's the mind which creates these things. It creates the change in our species, which was seen in that example of the cats in the coal mine in Wales. And it also changes our species. It is the mind which creates the heavens. It's the mind which creates the hells. And it's the mind which creates our world. You've all experienced, many of you, when you've fallen in love. When you've fallen in love, oh, just the whole of Kuala Lumpur is just so beautiful and wonderful. And just when the rain, it's just so lovely, just a beautiful rain. When the sun is out and the stars, oh, they're so romantic. When you've fallen in love, just the whole world is beautiful and lovely. But when you're getting divorced, the whole world stinks. The whole of Kuala Lumpur, oh, why am I in this terrible town? This, the whole weather is just so disgusting. Now you understand how you create your world. I know that many years ago, Ajahn Sumedho, who's the abbot of our monastery in England, when he was with Ajahn Chah, sometimes he'd have a bad time. He was, you know, suffering. And he told me once that Ajahn Chah came up to him one day and said, "Is this monastery suffering, or are you suffering?" And he realized that the monastery doesn't suffer. The monastery is just a monastery. He was suffering. He was creating the suffering in that monastery. Because if the monastery is suffering, it would be suffering all the time. But sometimes he was happy in that monastery, sometimes he wasn't happy. So for those of you who are married, is it your partner is suffering? Is it their fault? Are they creating your world? Or are you creating the world? Are you creating your partner? Or is your partner creating you? No, it's not your partner's not creating. You're creating them. You create your marriage. You create your world. You can even create your health. You are the creator. Or rather, your craving is. Your mind. When we understand that, the Buddhist origin of the world is not a physical world. The origin is science. It's very well understood. But the other part of the world, you know, which is the mind, your emotional world, which is the most important part, you can understand the Creator there. It's not some being up in the sky, nor is it science. It's not something out of your control. It's well within your control, because it's you. And that was one of the great insights of the Buddha. You create your world. Even these days, people don't realize just how powerful our minds are. I think I may have mentioned this story to you a few times before, but certainly when I first read it in the science journals, it really shocked me. It was the story of this man in Bristol jail over 100 years ago who was condemned to death by hanging. He was about to be hung the next day. They had capital punishment then. And these two psychologists had permission to perform this very gruesome experiment. They went to his cell the night before and they said, "Sir, the law has been changed. You still have to die tomorrow morning, but not by hanging. And the following morning you will have your throat cut. That's how we'll kill you." And they left this poor condemned man alone in his cell to think about that all night. And of course the poor man never had any sleep. When they came for him early in the morning, they tied the hands behind his back, put on a blindfold, and led him to the place of execution. there after doing some rites about reading out the sentence, having a priest in attendance, getting his last words, giving him a blessing, they drew the knife across his throat. He fell down to the ground and died. However, what he didn't know was that the person who was drawing the knife was just one of the psychologists, and the knife was blunt. It didn't even scratch his skin. But at the time the knife was being pulled across his throat, one of the other scientists turned on a tap because it was in the prison washrooms. The man felt a knife across his throat. He heard the sound of liquid coming out. He thought he'd had his throat cut, so he decided to die. And he did die. There was nothing wrong with him at all. It was one of those examples which shows how powerful our mind is. In perfect health, we can literally think ourselves to death. I don't know how many of you have seen people with cancers who have thought themselves to life. One of my disciples is a fascinating fellow. He's also from London. He's a little bit older than me, maybe 10, 15 years older than me. He has lung cancer. Both lungs completely riddled with the cancer. So bad that when he went to his specialist, the specialist showed him the x-rays and said, surgery is not an option because we can't take out both your lungs. You have nothing left. He said, even chemotherapy or radiation, all it can do, maybe, is extend your life for a few months. But if you want to do that, we'll do it for you. He sent the man home to talk it over with his family and to come back in a couple of weeks to tell him their decision. He told me that, talking with his family, he resigned himself just to let nature take its course. He'd given up hope, maybe a couple of months, that's all he had to live. But when he went back again, the oncologist insisted on doing another x-ray to see how the cancer had progressed. So when he went into the specialist's room, the doctor was looking at the new x-ray, shaking his head. And this fellow, his name is George, still comes to our monastery, thought, oh my goodness, it's worse. I haven't got months, maybe only days. So he asked the doctor, come on, give it to me straight. How many days have I got? It's got worse, hasn't it? And the doctor looked up and said, look, I'm not shaking my head because it's got worse. I'm shaking my head because it's disappeared. Completely. What the heck have you been doing? Within 2 weeks, and this was not theory, this was real because the x-rays were there. He showed him the two x-rays. One was riddled where there was no possibility of much of a solution at all, and the other one was completely clear. What have you been doing? And George said, meditating. And the doctor said, carry on. Sometimes that happens. It's strange. Just the power of the mind is intense. You can create with that mind if you really know how to use it well. So when we talk about the origin of the world, the origin of the world is not some sort of God outside of yourself. The origin of the world is not some sort of laws of science which are completely outside of you and it's all fate and you can't have any control over this at all. You create your world. You create heaven and hell. And you can even create the situation where you never need to go to hell again. For those of you who know a little bit more about Buddhism, have you ever heard that if you become a stream winner, that you don't need ever again to go to the lower realms of hell or the animal realm or the ghost realm? Why does that work? I'll tell you how that works. Because once you become a stream winner, once you understand the absence of this self, this ego, you can forgive all those faults. Even though you may have been naughty, you may have done things which were wrong, you can absolutely forgive them, let them go and move on. You don't need to punish yourself anymore. This is where you understand what forgiveness is all about. The stream winner has got that down perfectly. Why do we need to punish other people? Why do we need to punish ourselves? Punishment very rarely works. Compassion, forgiveness works much more powerfully. In fact, it's incredibly powerful when you've done something wrong and you expect punishment and someone comes up and forgives you and shows you kindness. There's so many stories when people have been expected to be punished when they've heard forgiveness. I remember reading this story a long time ago. This was an American man. He became a Buddhist and wrote about his life. His father caught him lying, so took him to the bathroom, took out the razor strop, was about to give him a whipping. At that, his grandfather saw what was going on, his father's father, and went to his son, this boy's father, and just said, "Don't do that." And the father of this boy, about to give the whipping, had a strop in his hand. "That's what you used to do to me when I lied. But I was stupid then. Don't do it." And he argued with his son, this boy's father. And the boy's father just walked away. The boy never got a stropping. And the grandfather just held him in his arms. And this little boy cried his eyes out. And he never lied again. He didn't need to be beaten. If he'd have been beaten, maybe he would have lied again, but next time make sure he wasn't caught. That's all. That's all punishment really does. Just makes us smarter next time so we don't get caught. But when it was something else, some forgiveness, it was far more powerful. Because the whole idea of that punishment was make sure you don't do that immoral act ever again. But it doesn't work. If you sort of punish your partner because they've made a mistake, they've done something wrong, they've told a lie, whatever else it is. If you punish them, scold them, shout at them, what does it do? Does that really help the situation? Or does that make your relationship even more distant, even more difficult? It's incredible sometimes when there's real forgiveness. That's the way that we learn. We don't do those wrong things again. And if we can forgive other people, how about the way we forgive ourselves? Okay, you may have done something wrong. You may have done some terrible crime. Some stupid thing. Why? Because you're deluded. You do stupid things. We all do stupid things. The point is we want to become wiser, and sometimes the punishment is the worst way of trying to learn. We just become afraid. But instead, if we get encouragement to do good things, encouragement works much more powerfully. I was in Java recently, and this man came along and asked me this question. He said, "I've got to shout at the workers in my factory, otherwise they're lazy. I've got to be angry at them to get them to work." And I said, "Listen, you're over in this talk at the moment. Are you really sure that your workers are actually on the job right now? Probably they only work when you're there. Because that's what happens when you shout at them, 'Oh, here he is, we better do some work.'" A lot of the time such control only works when you're around. And when you go, there's no reason to work. If its only reason to work is to avoid a scolding, avoid being shouted, you have to be there all the time. That's not the way to run a company, I said. You should encourage your workers. The carrot, not the stick. Because with the carrot, if you encourage your workers, and they want to work for you. They respect you. They understand it's in their interest and everybody's interest to work. You get much more work out of a person through encouragement than through fear. That's just so well known in psychology. It's the same for yourself. If you encourage yourself rather than punishing yourself, you get much more out of you. A lot of times we make mistakes, we hide them from ourselves. It's called denial, psychological denial. We've done something wrong, we don't admit it. I never did that, not me. Why is that? Because we're afraid. We're afraid of being punished. It's like in your relationship, you do something wrong, you're afraid of telling your partner because you're afraid of being punished. What sort of relationship is that when you can't share? Isn't it wonderful when we can actually tell the person we love, our partner, I've done a mistake, please understand, and please forgive? There's growth then. There's a possibility for acknowledging in a person who understands, who loves you. You're not afraid anymore of consequences of punishment. You can learn and you can grow. Now you can understand just why. A person who has that degree of wisdom, a stream winner, a noble one, who's understood the Dharma enough, can actually forgive themselves and forgive others. They don't send other people into hell, nor do they send themselves into the lower realms of hell. Just like that samurai warrior, that is heaven. Now and afterwards, you don't get angry anymore. You don't get angry at yourself, you don't get angry at others. You just create heavens. Those lower realms are no longer open to you. That's why the extreme winner, someone who's seen the Dhamma, never really gets too angry, never gets into punishment anymore. They live in heaven, in this world and the next world. Now you can understand why the Buddha said that those lower realms are not open to stream winners. Because we create those realms, and it doesn't make any sense to create those lower realms for oneself anymore. So this is what we mean by the origin of our world. The origin of the world is ourselves. We create those worlds. And because of that we are actually in that sense in full power of our destiny. We can create anything. Doesn't matter what you're experiencing now, you can create a heaven out of anything. Look at our monastery. My monastery down in Australia is very austere. We don't have televisions, we don't have videos, we don't have DVDs, we don't have music, we don't have a menu for what we're going to eat. We sleep on the floor, most of our monks, on cold little huts. You've been in those huts, you've seen what they're like, there's nothing much in there. I'd think even in the prisons in Malaysia, they're not as austere as that. You get 3 meals a day in the prisons, I think. I think some prisoners, if they behave themselves, are allowed to watch TV. So, some people think, wow, living in a monastery, that must be hell. But the point is, it does not matter the external situation, it's what you make out of it. And we make a heaven out of our austere monastery. When I was staying with Ajahn Chah, it was even more austere, but I really enjoyed that. I was interviewed recently, a couple of weeks ago, for the Straits Times. And I said, well, that must have been terrible. Why did you go and live in a monastery such as that, you know, eating frogs and lizards and ants and all that terrible stuff, being eaten by mosquitoes? And, you know, I had a degree from Cambridge. When I was at Cambridge, you know, butlers would feed you. And here you were just, you know, you had 9-course meals, you know, created by some of the best chefs. And now you're just eating frogs. I'd really gone down in the world. But the point was that, no, I was happy there. I created that my world. I realized the external situations weren't really important. If we think of the external, that science makes, you know, the material which you have to work with in life. Your body, the world you live in, the town you live in, the material you have to work with. But it's what you do with that, what the mind does with that. That's the most important part of the origin of your world. When you know you are the creator, that gives you full power to create a heaven for yourself. And if you're existing in hell, it's no one else's fault. It's your fault. You create that hell. No one else. Don't need to blame other people. You send yourself down there. You can let yourself go at any time. The door of hell is always open. Get out. The door of heaven is always open. Walk in. Come in. And the door of heaven, what is the door of heaven? Just like that samurai, forgiveness, gratitude, love, thank you. Thank you so much. Wife, thank you so much for being a good wife to me. You may not be the perfect wife, but you're good enough. You may not be like those girls you see in the magazines, but, you know, it's pretty enough. You've got a makeup here, makeup there will do. And husband, you may not be the sort of the coolest guy, but, you know, you're cool enough, that'll do. Little child, you may not be sort of the best at school, but yeah, you're good enough. Thank you, kid, for being sort of my son, being my daughter. See how you can create the world? Just like that samurai, you have ingratitude, friendliness, metta, forgiveness. That is how you create a heaven for yourself. Oh, this story which the German monks in my monastery read out to me once, because in my monastery have people from all sorts of different nations, and there's a couple there who are German-born monks. Actually, they're brothers. Their mother's very upset at me. She only had two sons, and both became monks. She said, "Couldn't you leave me one?" To have some grandchildren, I got them both. But they were talking about this German book, because someone had written a book about Germans who had out-of-the-body experience, had some accident or died on the operating table, I forget which, went floating out of his body and went sort of going off to this, what he described as a shed, a building. And this is, you know, this is from a Christian family, not a Buddhist. And it went to this, this is how he described it, because in the mind, this is not exactly how it is, but this is just how you perceive what's happening. He went to the shed, someone was waiting for him, said, "What's your name?" Looked in the book, said, "You're not in here, you're not supposed to be dead. Go back." You know what just happens to many people that have near-death experiences? They're told by somebody, "You're not supposed to be dead," so they go back into their body again, and they wake up. That's what happened to this little 9 or 10 year old boy. But this being at this little shed said, "Well, since you're here, you can stay around a bit and so see how it all works." And the next person who arrived was a German farmer. And this man asked this German farmer who just died, he said, "Have you killed any animals?" He said, "Oh, only one or two, not many." And this being turned around to this boy, "See, even though he's dead, he still lies." He'd been a farmer, he killed hundreds and hundreds of animals. But at that moment, the boy saw this other being who went right past the shed, and he saw him going upwards in this, you know, this stream of light and radiance. And said, "Why aren't you asking him what he did?" And this is the interesting part of the story. What I really remember this story, the reason why I remember that story was this story, this part of the story about this man just floating right past the shed. "Why aren't you asking him what he did?" And this being turned around to the boy, "That man, throughout his whole life, never judged anybody. Therefore, we're not going to judge him. He goes straight to heaven." And I thought, what a beautiful tale that was, coming from a 10-year-old boy who had an out-of-the-body experience when he was close to death. Because that makes so much sense. If you don't judge others, you don't judge yourself. You're not creating a hell for yourself. You create the heaven. You go straight up there. You create the world. Not a God, not science. Science creates the matter. But you are the creator. Once you understand that, you understand you're not a victim anymore. You can take control by developing powerful, positive states of mind. States such as generosity, states such as gratitude, states such as loving kindness, states such as peace, forgiveness, openness. Because if you create those states, which is classical Buddhist training, you are creating your world. You are the origin of that world. You make the world in which you're going to live in. You make your family life. You make your emotional life. You even make your health. So what a wonderful thing it is. And you can try me out. you can test out that theory, and you'll find it works. With those positive mind states of gratitude, you create heavens. Say how grateful you are to your parents, to your friends. You'll find you go straight to heaven inside your heart. And if you die at that moment of saying thank you, that heavenly state will last for many, many centuries. If you express your love to somebody, if you forgive the people who have hurt you, you feel that's what heaven is like. You created a heaven. If you can learn about harmony in your community, you create this beautiful, wonderful community in which you live. You can create a wonderful country, a wonderful world, because we are the ones who create it. It's not the world creates us. We create our world. So we understand just our responsibility, but also our power. No longer we are victims. Even in a tsunami, that's just the matter of the world. What we do about that, we can make a heaven out of that. Or we can make a hell. Making a heaven out of it is actually learning to have this marvelous opportunity to do something good. You all know that whenever there's any tragedies in a family, very often that's when the family come together. They put aside all the old stuff. They forgive, okay, our father has died. Out of respect for him, let's not argue anymore. Let brother and sister be friends once again. We can make a heaven out of a tragedy. So, when we talk about the origin of the world, we don't talk in the terms of, you know, 4, 5, 6 thousand years ago, some being created all of this. That doesn't make any sense to me at all. As a Buddhist, we say the physical world is well explained by science. Some 14, 15 thousand million years ago, a Big Bang created the matter of this universe. Not the first time, happened many, many times. More than that is actually the way of evolution. Craving actually motivates, so that the way that evolution spreads this way or that way, and how species evolve. And lastly, sort of the way, the most important thing is not just the beings, not just the world, but it's the mind. And that is our power. We are the origin of that. We are the creator. This is why the Buddha said in Dependent Origination, if it's with wisdom, we can create a heaven. If it's with delusion, we can create the hell of samsara. It's really up to us. You create your world. And that's the Buddhist answer to the origin of the world. Someone asked you, who created the world? You did. So, that's the 45-50 minute talk. Are there any questions about the origin of the world? So now's the time for questions. Yes, we've got the first question straight away, yeah. The law of karma. Remember that the law of karma isn't imposed upon you. You are the one who makes the karma. So the law of karma, of cause and effect, that we always interfere with karma. It's not fatalism. A good example of that is a story when I was, what age was I? I just finished university. I must have been 21. Or 21? Yeah, 22, I think. I decided to go and try and visit the holy sites in India. I was a Buddhist already, a lay Buddhist. So I went overland from Europe to India. And as soon as I got into India, I had a bit of diarrhea. So I decided to go and recuperate up in Kashmir. The only way to get there in those days was on the bus, this little coach, which went from, I think, Jammu, which was the... in the plains, over the mountains, into this beautiful valley of Kashmir. So I got on that bus. There was a couple of other sort of Westerners on that bus. And the driver was a crazy man. He was driving so fast And those roads up in the mountain, they weren't paved. They were gravel roads, only wide enough for one bus, single track. And if you looked out of one window on the bus, there was a vertical cliff going up. Looked on the other end of the other side of the bus, was another vertical cliff going down. And in those hairpin bends, sometimes boulders would actually roll down onto the road. And every now and again, you look down, you know, on the cliff going down, you see a bus just like the one you were on, which hadn't made it and actually had fallen over the edge. It was really dangerous. And so, you know, we sort of decided to ask the driver, can you slow down, please? And the driver said, look, if it's Allah's will, we fall over, it's Allah's will. I said, but I'm not a Muslim. And sometimes I really thought about, you know, what would actually happen? You know, okay, if it was like a Christian, they'd say it was God's will you fell over. A Hindu might say it was the law of karma. What would a Buddhist say? What would a Buddhist say? The reason why they fell over, because it was a bad driver, not karma. Now you understand the law of karma. It's a bad driver. It's the karma you're doing now. That's the most important one. It's what you're making of the situation. Okay, so, you know, you may have sort of a cancer, say, because, you know, you haven't been sort of looking after your body, you know, too much stress or whatever. Now that's sort of, you know, the karma from the past, but the most important part is what you're doing about it now. Because I know many people who've had cancer have made a heaven out of it. And so many people I've met have come up to me afterwards and say, that's the best thing which ever happened to me. I met so many wonderful people, and I never realized just how many people really loved me, how many people cared about me. It was one of the most wonderful times of my life. They made a heaven out of that disease. So it's not the thing itself, it's how you deal with it. You know, you have a tragedy like a death. How are you dealing with that? You can make a heaven out of anything, I found. So, the law of karma is always interactive. It's not like watching a movie, it's an interactive video. And a movie, it's already set out what's going to happen next. That's fatalism. This is interactive, where you can actually change the plot at every moment. So you never know what's going to happen next, because you are always interfering with the sequence of events. So, karma is interactive. It's not set. Does that make any sense? Sort of? Yeah. Is that exactly what you meant with your question? Yeah, okay, you're asking if a baby is born blind, is it because of what he did in the previous life? That may be the case, it may be just something else, because the Buddha said not everything is due to karma. Maybe it's because, you know, there was a doctor who helped with the birth, was a bit heedless and did a wrong procedure. It could have been because the mother sort of was taking prohibited substances or drinking or whatever. I don't know much about medicine, but sometimes it's other people's fault, not the baby's fault. But the point is, even if you are born blind, it doesn't mean that you can't grow in happiness and make something out of that life. Because I know many people who have had disabilities and become wonderful people. And they're happy, they made a heaven of their disabilities. I know other people who have just got all the great faculties. They've got rich parents, they're beautiful, they're talented, they're intelligent, and they seem to have so much good karma, they make a mess of their lives. So they're getting into drugs or doing stupid things. So it's actually what you make of what you've got. So you can make a hell out of good karma, or you can make a heaven out of bad karma. It's the karma you're doing now that's most important, not what you did in the past. So this is why you want to get away from fatalism. Getting away, it's God's fault, or it's karma's fault. Oh, poor me, I'm fated to have this happen to me. It's not the world creates you. You create the world. You can make something out of it. That's what I mean, the origin of the world is you. Any other questions about the origin of the world? This is actually classical Buddhism, dependent origination, and I just put it into new words. And use a bit of science, a few stories, to actually explain how it happens. Because sometimes people say, what about like rebirth? What is the process of rebirth? The two main parts of dependent origination in Buddhism, and the whole point of dependent origination was to show actually how rebirth happens. The two most important parts are karma and craving. And to understand that, I sort of use a simile. Suppose you want to come and visit me in Perth. So actually, to arrive in my monastery in Perth, you need two things. One is the will to go there, and the other one is the means to get there. You have to have the will and the means. You want to go, then you have to have the air ticket and the visa and the passport, all that sort of stuff. If you've got the will, but you haven't got the means, you haven't got a ticket, you won't get there. If you've got the ticket, but not the will, again, you won't get there. You need both. In that simile, the will to get there is called craving. The means to get there is called karma. With karma and with will, you will reach your goal. So, if you really want to go to this realm or that realm, you need the desire to get there and also the karma to get there. And those two together will propel you from one life to another after you die. And they will also propel you in this life, happiness or suffering. The most important of the two is your craving, what you want. What's always fascinated me is how people want to suffer. To me at first it was crazy. Why do people put themselves through so much pain and suffering? You don't have to do that. But people like it. Like sometimes you see me teach meditation, for example. Like, just take it easy, be compassionate, be kind, sit on a chair. People say, no, I don't want to sit on a chair, I want to suffer, I want to have pain. Crazy people. And you think that, you know, if you don't have pain, you won't get to Nibbana. And look what the Buddha did. And before the Buddha became enlightened, before he sat under the Bodhi, for 6 years, sort of he tortured himself. Now, not eating, sort of, I don't know, all the other ascetic things which he did. And the first teaching the Buddha gave after he became enlightened, what was the first teaching the Buddha gave after he became enlightened? The middle way, yes. And what was the middle way? He said, listen, please, don't hurt yourself. Don't go to such extremes. But do people listen to that these days? No, I'm going to sit for 2 hours. Even though it hurts, I'm going to get enlightened. Come on, 3 hours, 4 hours. I'm going to fast till it hurts. I'm going to sit on the floor. I'm going to make myself sit on the floor. We go through all these penances. I've hurt someone. I'm going to torture myself. I'm going to punish myself. This is called guilt. I can't understand why people do that. The Buddha said that's not the middle way. Forgiveness is the way. Forgive your partner. If they've done something wrong, forgive them. Doesn't matter what they've done wrong, forgive them. Show them your love. If you've done something wrong, forgive yourself. That's the way to heaven. It's also the way to Nibbana. It's called letting go. It's called giving, charity. Aren't you into dana? One of the greatest acts of giving is called forgiving. So isn't it wonderful? You feel so free when you've forgiven someone. It's not a problem anymore. You're free of it. If you carry it around, it's a burden of hatred, a burden of pain, a burden of putting yourself in hell. You don't need to do that anymore. Forgive. One of the great acts of giving, forgiving. Do it to yourself, do it to others, and you create a heaven.